Okay, well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Natural History Museum of Utah and to the fourth and final lecture of the 2012 Nature of Things lecture series. I'm Sarah George, the Executive Director of the Natural History Museum of Utah, and we're thrilled to have you here in the Rio Tinto Center on the campus of the University of Utah. We also want to welcome the audiences listening tonight on KCPW Public Radio 88.3 and 105.3 FM. We really appreciate the work that KCPW does getting the word out to the community and enabling people who can't physically attend the Nature of Things to listen to the live broadcast. So though tonight is the last lecture for this year's Nature of Things series, I also want to invite you to another lecture in a movie this month. On April 10th, we will be showing Werner Herzog's acclaimed documentary, Cave of Forgotten Dreams, at Science Movie Night, which is at the Downtown Library, and it will be followed by a discussion by rock art specialist Dr. Laurel Kastens that evening. The movie is about the Chauvet Caves in France, which house the oldest known pictorial creations by humans. Then, on April 26th, we are thrilled to have Dr. Jean Clot, the scientist featured in the movie, speaking at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. This lecture is co-sponsored by the two museums and by the Leakey Foundation. Both the movie and the lecture are free, and there are details on our website. So this is the sixth year of the Nature of Things lecture series. We are very honored to have the R. Harold Burton Foundation as our underwriting partner for the sixth year. Thank you very much. We also want to thank our partners, Rio Tinto, Kennecott, Utah Copper, the Clark Foundation, the Nature Conservancy in Utah, ATK Aerospace Systems, Myriad Genetics, Rocky Mountain Power, the Brady Family Foundation, and the University of Utah Department of Physics and Astronomy for their support. A special thank you goes to the Salt Lake County Zoo Arts and Parks Fund. These are funds that you, as voters in Salt Lake County, have supported to provide this level of educational and cultural programs throughout Salt Lake. So please do take a look at your program tonight, where we have a complete list of the partners who make this program possible. We are honored to have their support. The theme for this year's Nature of Things lecture series is sharing science stories. We developed this as a continued celebration of the opening of the Rio Tinto Center here, the new home for the Natural History Museum of Utah. Here, we tell scientific stories through exhibits and gallery programs. And so for this year's series, we assembled a group of speakers who talk about science in other ways. So far, we've heard from two scientists, Randy Olson, who became a filmmaker, and Brian Green, who continues to do science, but also interprets it for the public on television and through books. And then just 2 weeks ago, we had distinguished science journalist Sharon Bakley, who's an incredible writer. So tonight, we are delighted to present Jada Boomrod and Robert Krulwich, hosts of the public radio program Radiolab. I'm sure you're all here because of your happy addiction to Radiolab, which provides a wonderful perspective on science today. Tonight, we'll follow Jad and Robert as they weave tales that make tricky science into sticky stories. How do you make a good science story great? They will open up their playbook to share some of their secrets for turning the complex and confusing into the profound and memorable. Jad Abumrad is an award-winning producer and composer who's been called a new young master of the radio craft, and he was named a 2011 MacArthur Genius Fellow. Robert Krulwich is an Emmy Award-winning journalist and NPR science correspondent, who also has been hailed as the most inventive network reporter in television by TV Guide. So please join me in welcoming Radiolab's Jad Abumrad and Robert Krulwich.
Is yours on? Mine's on. Boop, boop, boop. You have to turn yours on, I think. Nope. You're going to have to shout the entire time, and I'm just going to whisper.
Hello, hello. Am I coming out?
Yeah, you're coming.
All right. Hi, everybody. Wow, that was easy.
All those people over there, like me.
I know. Because really what happens normally in a usual day for us is that it's something like this, except there's a pane of glass between us, because otherwise we would fight. And then it's very small. It's like the size of this little stage, and there's no one there. So the fact that you guys are here is it's a little frightening to us.
Mine's off now.
Oh, swapping mics?
Oh, should I replace this with that? Oh, this is... Oh.
Hello?
Oh.
Hello, hello.
We'd like six more, please, and maybe a couple bottles of Coke. Thanks.
Okay, well, thank you guys for coming. This is the coolest museum I think I've ever seen.
Yeah.
First of all, I think that must be said.
Yeah, they took us on the long-neck dinosaur tour upstairs. It's quite something.
Amazing. Yeah. So I'm glad that we... that the word sticky made it into the title, because that's a word that we actually use a lot when we're thinking about stories and trying to figure out how to tell these stories. And so we're going to try and let you in on some of the things we do to make things sticky, as obscene as that sounds, but it's not meant that way. And that's the sticky question led us to think about play and the role that playfulness and having fun, to put it, you know, dumbly, has in what we do.
Because we thought, wow, I sound so...
You sound very high-five.
Yeah. We thought when we began that the way usually science is reported, or economics or law or any of these things, is the reporter, you know, says, oh, I'm going to do a story about this, and then they go out and they interview people and they write it all down and they learn it and they get it right, and then they get into that voice, like in the commercial broadcasting company, that voice at the end. And that voice tells the audience that you know what you're talking about, and it's all done, you know, like, I have the knowledge, you listen, that'll be what we'll do today. But we decided we didn't want to do it that way, because we don't know very much when we start a project, and we're content to not know much at the beginning. And the idea of the show, one of the important political things about the show, is we want people to hear what it's like for two curious folks to just try to figure something out.
Yeah. Yeah. And oddly enough, you know, I mean, I'm sorry to fixate on this little physical space here, but you and I met actually not in radio. We happenstancely sort of found each other, and we began to have breakfast at this little diner at these little tables. And we would just
That's
share.
That's very mysterious. We were walking one day in the woods, and we
happenstantially
met each other and decided to have breakfast.
Well, I could do the whole story, but I think they would be bored by that. But so, you know, I feel like what you're describing wasn't so much a decision; it was just this is how we started to know each other, and so anything else felt weird, it felt false. So I don't know. We could play some clips, talk about it.
So this first thing we're going to play you is you would think if you go visit a scientist, particularly a famous scientist, that they would put on their tie and you put on your tie and you just go ahead and you be serious together. It is really interesting that if you walk into somebody's house like you don't know why you're there and you just want to be shown around and you just kind of fumble into everything, extraordinary things happen. So in this case, we're wandering into Oliver Sacks's house. He's a famous neurologist. And we noticed that there are very peculiar things in his house. For one thing, his bedspread is the periodic table.
Yeah.
His towels
are the periodic table. He had a periodic table.
So one of us goes to the bathroom, and we come and say, you know, your towels. So of course, I know. That's my bathroom. Those are my towels. And then things began to happen.
Yeah, so this is a short clip from a show that I can't even remember where it came from, but it doesn't really need to be set up. And this is us in Oliver's house. Am I getting sound from the laptop? Laptop sound?
Yeah, you need a laptop for us here.
Okay, let's, sorry, that was a little loud. Yikes, let's try that one more time. Turn it down a bit.
For us here. It looks like an old...
Let's gonna back that up a bit. All right. For all the marbles, here we go.
For us here. It looks like an old...
That's just not working, is it? Well, thank you and good night.
You know, this happens. One time we were in Seattle and we went on stage, and in the stage show of what we do, if you come, any of you coming to the stage show, he has everything in a box and it's all like everything is conserved and he keeps hitting the buttons and it's all, we try and pray that it'll work. And one time we walked onto the stage, there were like 2,500 people sitting there in Seattle, and the machine was dead. And I had no idea what you're supposed to do in a situation. The audience was there, everybody was seated, the lights went up, and we had nothing except a cellist. So someone in the audience yelled out, "That's why you have a cellist!" And so we got 6 minutes of cello music.
But that's not going to happen right now because we do have sound, so we're going to play this clip.
Describe what isn't before us here. It looks like an altar.
It's like a little dictionary stand on top of which was a beautiful mahogany box.
A fine wooden box.
About the size of a backgammon set.
Called Periodic Table of the Elements.
It is a very fine wooden box.
And if you care to open it...
Right, it's made of some sort of fine wood.
It comes from Russia.
It does. All right. Is there a trick to opening this?
Okay, we've all seen the periodic table, you know, on a chart, but in Oliver's box, there were the actual elements.
These are all these, we have here, like 90-some-odd little
tubes.
Little samples.
Little teeny vials.
Of almost all the elements. Silver, arsenic, bismuth, cobalt, oxygen, copper, hydrogen, phosphorus, iron, manganese, mercury, nitrogen, molybdenum, gold. Since I'm, for example, having my 72nd birthday tomorrow, and element 72 is hafnium, there is a little hafnium.
Two little rocks. Here's what they sound like if you rattle them.
I have coming to me, I hope it arrives today, an ingot of hafnium, which would be very much more satisfying.
What would you do with an ingot that you can't do with the two little pebbles?
I'll be able to hold it in my hand. My first love of chemistry had to do with the sensuous. Here, one of the liquid elements, bromine. I loved the colors, the brown,
faintly brown, fluidy thing.
The luster, pale golden mercury. Very, very beautiful. The physical properties.
This is a gas trapped in a little vial?
Yes. One wouldn't want to drop that.
Why not?
Well, it's not good to breathe.
Can I just jump in here for a second?
Sure.
Because I really need to jump in. But the thing that's really crazy about that box, and this you don't get from looking at a periodic chart on a wall, is that all those elements...
Lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen...
That's like the world. I mean, everything that we can see and perceive, this table right here, the teeth in my mouth, the sky, the ocean, the mountains, it's all... made of some combination of elements from that box. And the box itself gives it all a deep, deep order.
So that's just like working with a crazy guy in his house, really. And just wandering around from the bathroom to the living room and so on.
Yeah.
And there is, however, if once we got interested in the glories of how the universe is constructed from every little bit in his box, you can then land a couple of minutes later, after we've told the story of a Russian man who thought up that there might be some connections between gases and stones and some mathematical logic to the whole thing, you can end up in a big, fat place.
Yeah, you end up asking sort of one of the deeper questions you could ask. Is the order of the periodic table something that is there in the world for man to discover, or does man impose it on the world? And that's sort of where we ended up. But for me, I mean, I like that clip because the periodic table is like the quintessential puzzle as a person who wants to communicate science. I mean, it's amazing and yet so insanely boring at the same time. I mean, it's a table in a grid that you learn in school, and you don't really quite know what you're learning, but it is actually the world at the same time. So for me, I think one of the things we're constantly trying to do in this show, and in that clip for me gets it across, is to make this stuff feel visceral. Like, it's not a table, it is the very matter in our bones and in our flesh and in our teeth. It's part of our bodies. To make the radio feel like it's coming from your body rather than just something that can be experienced cerebrally.
Now, needless to say, the scientist, when we visit, we usually arrive with the microphone already on, the tape recorder already going, and we haven't even said hello yet. And so they look at the tape recorder and they say, like, we're just recording. And we record the doorknob, and we record, he will record anything, really.
Yeah, so, you get all the little incidental sounds of, like, discovery, and the doors, footsteps.
But this would make an ordinary adult nervous, like, when does it start? It seems to have already started. And what are the rules here? And what happens is, because we're sort of being silly, I mean, this is the power of being the ones with the microphone. Yeah. If you arrive with the microphone, then it's your game. Now, they know somewhere deep inside that if they're going to play with you, they have to play with you on your terms. And since you're rummaging through their linen closet, they don't quite know what to do, so they just go along with you. Or they could throw you out. And we'll get to some of those. But
yeah.
The business, however, is really a secret handshake. We want them to know that we will make every effort that we can to make sense of whatever it is they have to say. And we ask them to trust us in the act.
Yeah.
So sometimes they squeal, like that person just did. But we'll give you an example of this next person you're going to hear is one of the great storytelling scientists around. Her name is Cynthia Kenyon.
Yeah, she studies worms and has actually found something in these worms that is quite remarkable. And she's very media trained. She's as media trained as they come. So this is actually a very representative piece of tape of something that we collect when we interview scientists. And this is unedited. So we're going to play you just the raw tape first. And this is somebody who I think she's been interviewed 1,000 times.
And we asked her a very basic question. She studies, since she got a worm, to live longer than any worm normally lives as long as. She seems to have unlocked some secret about aging. And she's trying to describe the secret that she's unlocked. She's got two genes. One gene is a kind of a youth gene, and the other gene is a kind of, I think it's time to die gene. Mm-hmm. And they have technical names, DAF-16.
No, let's hear the tape. Play you this just to let you know.
But imagine we're just holding a microphone into her mouth,
Yeah, so I mean, the linen closet version of the story that we gave you with Oliver is one way that things happen. And Oliver is wonderfully sort of personable that way. This is the other version, and this is the one that we generally bump into.
The DAF-16 gene makes a protein called the DAF-16 protein. And that protein binds to the DNA where other genes are, and it activates or deactivates a whole bunch of other genes in the DNA. So the way it works is that the hormone binds to the DAF-2 receptor. And when that happens, DAF-2 receptor kind of squashes the activity of DAF-16. It turns it down. Okay? So DAF-16 can't bind to its genes in the DNA and make them more active. Okay? So when you come along with a mutation or some other way and you inhibit the activity of the receptor, now you liberate DAF-16. It's free. It springs into action. And it activates about 100 genes in the DNA. And these 100 genes each do a little tiny good thing for the cell.
I love how you're like, oh, I see. You don't know what she's
saying. No, we didn't know what she was saying. Inhibit the something of the cell. We think, oh, okay.
Yeah, well, see, that clip is kind of an interesting puzzle because it's got two things going on. You've got these DAF-2, DAF-16 receptors. These are things that nobody in their normal life meets. Like, what is a DAF? I'm sure there is a perfectly sensible reason for why it's called DAF.
Yes, it's Mr.
But what is it?
It's Mr. Heard of Robert E. Lee? There's Daffy Duck, who's a...
Right.
Right.
Well, no, but see, that's that I can imagine. I don't know what a DAF is. So you've got the DAFs. That's an issue from a storytelling perspective.
You couldn't really imagine that. Well, I got you good.
Duck. Right. The other thing, though, is that you also heard in her tape really interesting words, like, I don't know, what were they? Liberate, spring, squash. There was a squash in there. These are like action movie words, right? These are like, these are good verbs. So we have good verbs, we have bad nouns. So we've and that's a very ordinary problem for us. And that things are happening, processes are in play, you know, life is changing. There's things that are exciting, except things that are doing the things that are exciting are incomprehensible. So
we fix it.
We fix it. So here was our approach. And this, given that we had a nomenclature problem, we had DAFs, we just changed the nouns. Sort of noun replacement therapy is what we did. And so this is the result, which is an interesting thing because it raises questions about like how stupid do you want to be? You know, like there are some basic questions that you run into.
Also, try to imagine, as you hear this, try to imagine Cecilia Kenyon hearing this for the first time.
So this was our attempt to solve it.
So what exactly is this gene doing to make them live longer?
Well, maybe we should ask the question a different way, because the worms that lived longer, they didn't actually have this working gene.
Right. When we make a mutation in the DAF2 gene, we damage it. That actually causes it not to work as well. So that actually is kind of profound. That tells you right away that the worm has a gene in it that's shortening the worm's lifespan.
Which is why she calls it
the Grim Reaper gene.
The Grim Reaper gene.
It's the gene that makes you die.
If you're a worm.
Right. So, by damaging this gene, Cynthia and her team essentially are taking the Grim Reaper and knocking his knees out.
No, stop that! Ow.
Okay, so the question is, what exactly is the DAF2 doing to make the cell age more quickly?
Here's where the story gets a little weird.
Well, we found another gene whose name is also DAF, but it's a different DAF. It's called DAF16.
DAF16!
And this is a gene whose normal function is to keep you young. It's like a fountain of youth gene.
Yeah!
So, wait, there was a Grim Reaper gene before.
Right.
And now there's a fountain of youth gene?
That's what she discovered. And inside the worms, these genes are struggling with each other. Here's how it works when a worm ages normally.
The DAF2 receptor...
DAF2.
...kind of squashes the activity of DAF16. It turns it down.
Silence!
And so the worm ages.
Okay. So when you come along and you inhibit the activity of the DAF2 receptor...
Ouch!
...now you liberate DAF16. It's free. It springs into action. And it activates about 100 genes...
One, two, three...
...in the DNA.
Go!
These 100 genes each do a little tiny good thing for the cell, and altogether it makes the cell live twice as long.
So you see, you can't just spring that on somebody. So when we designed it, we had to call her and say, like, here's our plan, are you okay with this, and so on. And you would be amazed by the number of scientists, sometimes of considerable serious mien, who will go along with it. If they feel that you're trying as hard as you can to understand what it is they're saying, we do not pretend to be, you know, the kind of quick processors that can grab on to the fastly thought thoughts of fast-thinking people and think them fast along with them. We are what we would call the slow processors. And we wait until we understand it. This means that a lot of our interviews include things like, excuse me, so are you saying, if a cow were to get run over by a bus, are you saying it would fall to the left? Is that what you're saying? And you get these looks from these people at first, like, I pity you. But you have to be willing to be stupid in front of these smart people in order to be smart with them.
Yeah, and I, you know, initially I had a tough time defining my job that way, because for me there is the idea that you would take someone's work, someone's passion, someone's research, and God knows people who do this kind of research, they fail for years and years and years before they get one small shred of something they can stand behind. So like the idea that you would take that and then just make some dumb radio with little people chirping, like that feels, I feel like I don't want to do violence to that kind of work.
the same time you want to understand it. But I kind of came to a certain way of thinking about it myself, in that like it's a tension that you have to maintain, and that as the person who's doing the research, you're somebody who's in charge of the full complexity of the information. As a person who wants to explain it, you have to somehow steal some of that complexity away. And there is some kind of, it's like tuning a string. You have to somehow, I feel like we are in some sense the string that's taut between those two poles. And we are not one or the other, but our job is to kind of continually tune the level of information and the level of detail so that it is extremely immediate, but at the same time, it doesn't do violence to the science. And so what he was saying just now is really important. So what we end up doing, and we did this with Cynthia Kenyon, is you get a first draft, maybe a third draft, you call her up and you say, okay, here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna have a little girl play deaf, 16. We're gonna have a Shakespearean actor play deaf, 2. Are you cool with that? And she'll be like, yeah, but just say, if you're a worm in the middle there. Like, okay, so we'll throw that in. And so you start to kind of tune the string, and you get the string just at the right tension where there's those kinds of things that honor the complexity and the nuance. At the same time, you can be very, very kind of cinematic and clear with people. And that takes a while, and so we end up going through probably 5 or 6, sometimes 10 more drafts than I think.
Yeah, you might wonder like exactly how we do this. Well, we thought about Ira Glass, who we admire greatly, and we thought, now, we have to do something that doesn't sound like him, and the thing that we, and his show, so the thing that we noticed is that he's scripted a lot of the time, so you can hear people reading. So we decided that you would never hear us reading, and then we decided that we might as well not read. So we figure out what we're going to do, and we sort of write it out, sometimes in script form, sometimes not, sometimes in plot points. And then we get the tape, and we put the tape in an order, and then we go into the room, like he says, with the glass in between. I'm never entirely sure why there's glass in between, but I think maybe he thinks I have a virus or something. No. So then we then proceed to talk from the sound here to the sound there. We have a list, and then he gives me instructions, like, you know, less or more or faster, and oftentimes it's quite musical, like, I need more vivace, or I need more of this. And we then just say these things over and over and over. And then we do a best of, and then I know, it's horrible. And we do a best of, and then we try and we edit it again. And meanwhile, Cynthia Kenyon is then brought back, or whoever, mm-hmm. is brought back into the mix or the report. And we have to, could you just say, I like you to say that. I said, well, I just said I like you to say that. You said I like you to say that. We like to say, I like you to say that. So this gets insane, you know, and people look. But there is and this is mostly Jad, but there is, in Jad's conception of how to go about this, an intense, very articulate musicality. And it leaves everyone around him doing insane things, like saying that about 3 times. And then he edits them, and then you do them again. And you think, well, why? And then gradually you realize that what's going on here is that his way of reimagining what we have together imagined is so subtle that it almost feels like you're composing an orchestral piece. Even though it's words, it's just got all this layer upon layer upon layer of subtlety, and it works extraordinarily well to capture and hold people's attention. But it's he's one of the only people I know who is working in the news business as with a compositional sense so strong that you often sometimes forget that you're doing news and you're actually singing the news in some ways, which we'll get to, by the way, in a bit. I think, though, that the other thing that he does, and this is that the forms in which the stories are told can sometimes get radically nutty, and he sometimes comes up with really good ones. So in this next one, we're trying to describe the autonomic nervous system. Now, this is hard because this is when your heart beats or you breathe and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You aren't aware of those things, you just do them. But it turns out that men and women do them differently. And
this was part of a show about brain-body loops. You know, you have a feeling. Where does the feeling live? Is it in your head or is it in your body? Or is it some conversation between them, which is an abstract way of thinking about it. And we were trying to sort of battle that abstraction, make it concrete. And we came upon this really interesting bit of research about paraplegics, people who lose limbs, report feeling less emotion as a result. They have less body, and somehow the bodies are these tuning forks for emotion, and they have less, and they feel less. So we were very interested in that. And then you get to the thing that Robert was talking about, this very peculiar discovery about the gender difference between the speed at which men and women process emotion. And
you can get mad together, but you get unmad at different tempos.
And so there was
seemed to me to be like, I thought, oh my God, this explains every fight that people have in couples.
So
we have to do this.
We decided to actually honor that sentiment and bring it into the piece. So this is what we did.
The studies reported that people who had once been able-bodied and then became paralyzed felt
less
happy than able-bodied people, less sad than able-bodied people, just less.
Our being is rooted in a body state. If I would be able to remove from your brain the representation of your body, you would not know that you were you.
And would I not be sorry at my friend's death?
You definitely would not be sorry at anything. What is, in fact, the essence of being joyful or sad if you don't hook those notions on a changed body?
He's right, you know. I mean, if you think about the last time you were sad, like really sad, how would you describe that feeling to yourself?
Well, in fairness, I guess I would. I would say I felt dragged out and heavy.
Yeah,
and
that
I
feeling is completely rooted in your flesh.
Well,
the brain has nothing to do with it.
A thought made me sad, and then my body felt.
Oh, crap. I forgot to turn the ringer off. Hold on. Hello? Oh, hi. Yeah, hold on one second. It's your wife.
Here? Hello?
Robert?
Yeah?
I can't believe you're still there. What are you doing there?
What do you mean, what am I doing here?
You were supposed to be home an hour ago.
Tamar, you called me in the studio. We're on the air.
I don't care.
What do you mean you don't care?
You were supposed to be home an hour ago. I reminded you this morning. I reminded you last night.
It's
just not important to you.
There's not such a big deal. I'll be back in 10.
Actually, this is a perfect example of what we've been talking about.
No.
Robert's having a fight with his wife, Tamar, and while he's fighting, inside his body, his stomach is clenching, his heart is palpitating, hers is doing the same. Their brains are picking up these signals and thinking, anger. Feel angry.
So I'm working with other people here. There are other people who are
just as important as your work, and you've now screwed it up.
How did I screw it up? How did I screw up your work?
Now, at a certain point, Robert will probably realize he has screwed up, and
just get home.
He'll apologize.
Okay, if I get home in 20 minutes, well, I'm really sorry. I know this is horrible.
Robert, is everything okay?
Yeah, it's just a second. I'm really sorry.
Okay. Maybe
Now, when it comes to brains and bodies and men and women, the interesting thing is that when a man and woman fight, these systems in their body, the heart palpitating, the stomach clenching, while these systems do turn on at the same speed.
And it takes 2 seconds.
According to Robert Spolsky.
Where there's an interesting gender difference is how long it takes to turn off the system.
And ladies, sorry in advance.
And in general, it turns off more slowly in women than in men.
Which may explain something that happens to couples all the time.
Okay, I'm really sorry.
This just isn't right.
I know. Well, I'm really sorry.
Here we are.
Maybe later we'll go do something, or I'm really sorry.
Robert's stomach is relaxing.
This is really stupid, I know.
His heart is slowing.
Very stupid.
He thinks the fight might be over.
Okay. But, you know, this is something you do all the time. Remember when we were having a dinner right after we got engaged and we went to the restaurant and I was waiting for you and I made the reservation and
that was in the Carter administration.
I was sitting there for 45 minutes. You didn't even call.
I just apologized.
Did you hear what just happened there?
It's this William James stuff coming back to haunt us a century later.
Sapolsky says sometimes the body actually tricks the brain. Tamar knows the fight is over mentally, but her body is still tense. Her heart is still racing, and her brain thinks, wait.
If my heart is still racing and I consciously know that this issue has been resolved, it must be because I'm still pissed off about that thing that happened in the Carter administration.
You minimize everything does for you.
The brain fills a vacuum.
What, do you have a list? You have a list there or something?
I do. I have a long list. Do you know how often you do this sort of thing?
I do it like once.
No, I can count on this. You know, the babysitter calls if I'm going to be out of town and says, should I make dinner for Robert? Because, of course, you can't make dinner for yourself and the kids. No.
I do make dinner. I don't do much of anything. Baked potatoes last week, Wednesday. I made the baked potatoes.
That's just applying heat.
She says baked potatoes is just applying heat.
Just applying heat.
My sister called me up after this and said, don't ever do that again. That is actually my real wife, and she was in on it. The whole thing was a sort of stage, but it got so real it became frightening.
Yeah, I remember she walked out of the studio and she was like, oh, I'm sweating. I got into it there.
So the point here is, however, that we also believe that extraordinary things are going on all the time in our ordinary lives. Mm-hmm. And that one of the fun ways to explore a subject is to pull it from the textbook or from the lecture hall or from the academy and stick it right back in the lives that ordinary people live. Men and women fight all the time. Men and women make up all the time. There is this trouble on the back end. And this is something that it's very cool to know. Yeah. And then to actually have my own wife get into it to the point where it actually almost became real is a sort of lesson inside a lesson. Yeah. That, you know, even recalling your body rhythms gets your body rhythms up and down in the way. So this is the fun of it.
Yeah, and there's also like a sort of a political, a very hidden political agenda in something like this. You know, I am reminded of the difficulty of explaining things to people every day. Like, there are limits to what you can explain to a person. But if you make that person experience the thing you're trying to explain, then it's like this, they've jumped this unbridgeable chasm, and they're on the other side, and suddenly they go, oh. And we always sort of, we got to thinking at one point about the way in which science is taught in this country. And there's things that happen when you're in first, second, and third grade that are very tactile. Science is a set of experiences that you have. It's a set of science fairs. It's putting an egg in a bag full of salt water and throwing it out the window to test buoyancy, which was an actual experiment I did, and the egg broke. But it's something you do with your hands. It's something you engage physically, directly. And then there is something that happens right around the Krebs cycle. I blame the Krebs cycle, where suddenly it becomes a series of things that you have to memorize, and there's that person in the class who raises their hand very quickly, and suddenly they're the person who knows what science and you're not, and so you think, oh, well, maybe I'm not going to do science. Maybe I'll go be a musician, and which is what happened to me. I do think it was right around the Krebs cycle time. So there is something in what we just did here, which is a decidedly third grade. You know, we're trying to experientialize this information, really make it an experience, really make it about a fight that could happen right in front of you rather than one that we just describe. Because describing somehow doesn't make things sticky.
Is the next one sometimes things behave?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so here's every so often you get a chance, and this happens so rarely, you get a chance to actually share with your audience what it would be like to hear some discovery as if for the first time. And this has happened in the 6 or 7 years we've been doing this. We have had very few. But Jed did find this one. He met this lady who had this interest in sound and words and music and the relationship between the spoken word and music. And part of her research was the most silly thing, really. She would take the spoken word, 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 and loop it. She would just attach a phrase back and forth to itself, to itself, to itself, to itself, so it would just repeat. And she believed that some secret would be revealed by taking the spoken word and looping it, and that it had something to do with music. So what you're about to hear is, what you're about to have is a discovery. And this is the best that it gets. I don't even know if we should say anything else.
I'll tell you what happened is that when you do post-production, as you know, of speech, you loop things, so that you can zero in on P's, put, etc. sound too loud, you need to unpop, or S's that sound too sharp, and so on. So you put things on loops in order to fine-tune the way the speech sounds. So I had this particular phrase on a loop and forgot about it.
What phrase was this?
It's a phrase that occurs at the beginning of the CD in which I say, the sounds as they appear to you are not only different from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely as to seem quite impossible. Now, I had sometimes behaved so strangely looped. The sounds as they appear to you are not only different from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely.
Just those few words. And forgot about it.
So here's what happened. Diana leaves her studio. She closes the door, goes into the kitchen to make some tea. All the while, this loop is whirring away in the background. As she's sipping her tea, she thinks, is someone singing? Who's singing?
I heard what sounded like song in the background.
She realized, wait a second. That's not singing, that's me talking.
That very phrase.
So strangely.
But at this point,
sometimes behave so strangely.
It appeared to be sung rather than spoken. Right? Yeah. You still hear the words, but they're sung words rather than spoken words.
It's weird, like it just switches at a certain point. Three or four repetitions in.
Right.
It's going, and then pow, it becomes music. And then now none of us can get it out of our head. Like the whole office is like, sometimes behave so strangely.
And you know what? If you do this demo and then you go back to the original sentence, it sounds like, you know, speech to begin with. And when you come to that very phrase, I seem to be bursting into song.
The sounds as they appear to you are not only different from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely as to seem quite impossible.
I have to say this can continue for months and months. It's sort of like your brain gets altered for that particular phrase and it continues to sound like singing. For a very, very long time.
All right, so here we have just one small indication that music is, well, it behaves very strangely. I mean, think about this. We started with some basic speech, repeated it a few times. Somewhere along the way, it leapt into song. How did it change like that? And if that's all it takes to turn something into music, then what exactly is music, really? I was totally obsessed with this. This was a revelation for me because I sort of, at the very beginning of kind of figuring out how this show needed to sound, happened upon Walter Murch, the great film editor, who has this great schematic that he, I think, stole from linguists, where he had, it was a line with two brackets, and on one end was words, on one end is music. And he had a very sort of elaborate philosophy about the middle ground between words and music. And it was amazing to me that you could just repeat a word and make it into music. That's awesome. And so I spent like months repeating things needlessly, annoyingly, just any words, just repeat. And we would get letters about this because it just seemed like a magic trick that we could keep doing. But anyhow.
Well, here's the other thing, is that when you begin to sort of ask, who can do this with me, you get the scientists because they're in the business. But in the Sometimes Behave So Strangely, we went up to a high school in New York City called the LaGuardia High School, it's called the School of Music and Art. And there's a choral conductor and he has a class of kids who are do choral music. And we took the project of Sometimes Behave So Strangely and many other projects to this class, to this teacher. These are 15 and 16 year old kids. And we'll say to them, okay, what we'd like you to do is, can you, for example, I think one of the times we went and we said, two very important brain theorists believe that when you think of a cup of coffee, which contains many thoughts in it, you see something mocha-ish, you smell coffee, it comes in a round cup, it has a particular set of resonances, maybe your father likes coffee, maybe you have someone you know with coffee breath. Coffee is a mini splendid thing in your brain, and this particular theorist thinks that various places in your head start to oscillate when you have a thought called cup of coffee. And a thought called cup of coffee is just all those different sections of your brain vibrating together. This turned out, this is Francis Crick of Watson and Crick who thought this up. It turns out to be wrong, but we didn't know it at the time. And so we asked these people, these kids, to go ahead and create a cup of coffee musically for us. So they went out. We thought they'd do a barbershop quartet or something. They came out. They came back in. First they did some sort of freeform kind of like freestyle sort of hip-hop thing. Then they came in and did a set of rounds in which they just said round, 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 hot, hot, hot. It was just sort of syncopation. They tried African. They went out. They did a Bach fugue. They came back. And we turned to the teacher and said, how many? When, they kept coming back. They would go out. They come back. They go out. They come back. And they kept going on. And I said, well, how long? He said, they're 15, 16. And they'll do this forever, really. But I remember looking at Jed on the floor. He had all these contraptions to record them. And these are looks we sometimes share. Like, it is so wonderful to be in the company of various people, be they strange towel neurologist or kids in a high school, or if you come to the show tomorrow, dancers and comedians. I mean, tomorrow's show was conceived by us, but executed by people who love science, who happen to dance for a living, and who happen to make comedy for a living. And they pretty much not only helped us design the show, we gave them whole hunks of it because they were better at it than we are. The thing is that if you have a complex tale to tell, there are enormous number of people who will help you tell it. There are musicians, comedians, dancers, scientists, teachers, and all sorts of people you would never consider who will pitch in. And part of the joy of doing this project is we make as big a tent as we could imagine and ask as many people to stand under it with us to do this together. Because this business in a republic of talking about complexity, particularly complexity that will affect us, whether it be global warming or whether it be stem cells or whatever, what have you. This is not something we should leave to the learned to do. This is something that everyone, is a conversation that everyone should have together. This is not a privilege to do this. It's sort of a responsibility as a citizen to do it. And one of the deep thoughts we have about this program is we want to model what it's like to be interested and stay interested, even though it's embarrassing, even though you feel stupid some of the time, even though it gets very silly. The underlying purpose is deeply serious. And that's really our, I guess we could end there and ask, yeah. You ask questions if you want, but that's our deep feeling.
Do you guys have questions for us? I believe there are gonna be some people with some mics.
We'll get some mics and then you can.
There's a question from the internet.
Oh, we need to do a station ID, too.
Station,
do we want us to read it?
Sure.
Okay.
Do you want to read it?
You can read it. Yeah, read it.
So you are listening to the Natural History Museum of Utah's Nature of Things on KCPW 88.3 and 105.3 FM in Salt Lake City. We do have questions coming in from WNYC on the internet, if that's correct. And we have two microphones in the audience, so we'll take questions. Raise your hand.
Should we go live and humans or virtual humans first?
Let's do an in the house person first.
All right, let's
if
go
we
live
can get
human
to him.
First.
How do you get people to experience global warming so that they can feel it?
You know, that's a really good question. It's a sort of revolving conversation we've been having the last 6 months is basically that. It is sort of engineered to be the most abstract and unconcrete topic. It's so far away. You don't feel like you can do anything about it. People jump right to despair. That's probably the hardest challenge. But
or to anger because they don't think it's happening. Any of those. It's also something that newsrooms don't like, in my experience. This is working in the commercial side. At ABC and CBS, there was a real, please let's not go there. It'll bother people, make them angry, and make them sad. And we don't want to do that. We do enough of that in the regular newscast. So when you decide to tackle a global warming problem, you are in a tactical corner because people will, when they hear it coming, will growl or shrug. And neither of those moods are the moods that would say, all right, let's begin to... You know, that's just not... So it's very hard to do. In fact, it's a category, it's a category that is almost interesting because it's so hard to do.
Yeah. And there's also just, there are layers of things we know and layers of things we don't know. And it's very hard to be a responsible journalist when you have to somehow, I mean, the pieces that are often done have this kind of catastrophic, kind of alarmist tone to them, because that kind of attention works narratively, grabs people and pulls them in. It's hard to talk so much about probabilities and models and here's what's agreed on and here's the thing that we don't know that's going to happen but we think is going to happen. It becomes complex very quickly. But actually, to give you a short answer, I think in the next year we're probably going to try and really crack it. I mean, it's something we've talked about for so long that we really
want. Yeah, we also talked about it with Ira. We want to think maybe we should do it as a collective, as a bunch of us maybe, to give it a try. But
and when I say crack it, I don't mean that in any sort of grandiose way. Just like, what can we bring to the conversation?
Yeah.
That's been eluding us.
We're getting a big signal from, yes.
You mentioned earlier a conversation you had, talking about a theory by Francis Crick that turned out to be wrong. As science communicators, how do you deal with the responsibility of needing to be right when you, in the things you communicate?
Oh, we just had one of that with, the tongue.
We could, we can play something.
Yeah, play, yeah.
I'm glad you asked that question, and we'll pay you later. So here's the thing about what we do, which is quite liberating, is that a normal journalist kind of goes out, interviews their subjects, goes back, does an edit with the editor, fact checks, does all kinds of things, sweats, is confused, then goes and does some more research, is unconfused, does three or four more interviews, and then finally talks to the listener as if from a podium saying, here's what I know. And we've taken a decided approach where we kind of do all that first stuff in front of the audience. And so there have been times, and I'll give you an example right now, where we've been beautifully wrong, you know. In fact, we did a piece about.
Yeah, this is a tricky. The subject was that while you wake up in the morning and the sun goes up and then it usually goes down in the evening and it seems to come up in the same direction and go down, that there seems to be a great regularity in nature. The giraffes seem to always have baby giraffes and never baby hippopotami. It just doesn't happen. That when you get down to the details at the very bottom of weather or biology, you find a lot of what's called stochasticity, a lot of chance. And somehow or other, things just get orderly somewhere above the level of chance.
So the question was, how do you, I mean, if you go down to the fundament, the very bottom of us, the neurons, the cells, they're screwing up constantly, like at alarming rates, sometimes 40% mess ups in some of these like just basic gene making a protein. So how are we all here if 40% of the time the things that make us are messing up? So Carl Zimmer, a guy we talk to quite often, said, you know, I think what has happened is the body has engineered, particularly when you talk about brain cells, the body has engineered noise filters. So you've got a lot of noise, it's coming up, and somehow the body is filtering it out. And I thought, oh, noise filter, it's one of my favorite things in the world, is a noise filter. I won't bore you with the geeky details. But I had just happened to get a friend of mine named Little Wing Lee had a cassette of her grandma. It was really noisy. And she was like, can you clean it up for me? I thought, oh, I can clean it up for you, and it can become an explainer piece about genetic noise filters. And so,
he comes into the studio. Carl Zimmer is in the studio. He's talking to us. We often, when we don't know what we're talking about, we bring him our work. We say, this is what we're going to do. And we expect him to smile happily and say, absolutely. But just change the word from green to gray-green. We go, thank you, Carl. But that's not what happened in this case.
So, I'll drop you somewhere in the middle of it. I don't quite know where we are in this piece, but let's just take a shot. And you'll hear Carl's honest reaction. He doesn't really pull his punches when he tells us what he thinks. Singing old slave songs and old hymns. My friend Little Wing, her grandma, who she calls Mima, this tape had her singing old slave songs. Well, that's apparently where we are.
singing old slave songs and old hymns. Now, Little Wing's grandmother died last year.
She was 99 years old.
Wow. And they were really close.
Yeah, very close. They used to call me Little Mima when I was a kid.
So she's got these tapes. She wants to hear them. The problem is, if you put it on for more than 3 minutes, you get annoyed.
And there's that weird, like...
It's too noisy.
It was kind of overpowering.
Yeah.
She wanted to know if I could do something about it.
Yeah.
So, real quick, here's what I did. I put it into a computer, launched an EQ program, found the bass noisiness, which was around 600 hertz, dialed that down, like so. Then I found the high frequencies, which are around 2,000 hertz, dialed that down. Ah, now, as a final step, I just kind of located the voice around 1,000 hertz and dialed it up. Okay, so it's not a flawless process. I mean, now she sounds like she's coming out of a well, but for the first time, you can hear her voice.
I don't know. This is the first time I'm hearing this song, but it seems like she's describing the night that my grandfather passed away, talking about the doctors telling her that my grandfather has passed, and then she's describing putting a fern in his hand, and she said it should be a rose.
It was the end, and at last, goodbye.
The thing that's applicable here is that we started with this, and then just by bringing certain frequencies down and others up, we ended up with this.
I felt like I wanted to cry.
This might be how it is in the body, that you've got this noise all the way in the bottom, these genetic circuits which are spitting out messiness, but somehow just on top of that are other genetic circuits which are cleaning it all up, giving it a shape. Wait, what? Is that not right?
Not quite.
Damn it! Science! What's wrong with it?
Well, in our cells, there's no grandma.
What do you mean there's no grandma?
You don't start off with some very clear signal that gets masked by noise. The noise is there from the start.
Huh?
It's noise, and then whoop, all of a sudden you have this beautiful song.
Carl went on to explain, and it took like an hour for us to finally get this.
There's nothing but
noise down there at the bottom, and yet somehow out of that noise, the song emerges like a phantom. It's almost as if the noise is somehow filtering itself.
Mm-hmm. So if we were to get the analogy right, Little Wing would hand Jad a tape with just fragmented sound.
Little bits of Meemaw.
Little bits of Meemaw in all kinds of random ways.
Maybe she gave you 8 or 9 tapes.
And somehow he says it all starts to kind of get into a network where this one filters that one and that one filters...
I'll just stop it right there. But, I mean, what you heard was a condensed version of a 2-hour conversation about how wrong we were, that we then... We fell into...
Jad's head fell on the desk.
I had just made this beautiful
Carl
little...
Carl looked all embarrassed, have said, no, you know. And but we don't have a choice in this matter, is the answer. It was like, if we're wrong, we're wrong, and we have to do it again.
But there's a beauty in being wrong and then amending it, you know? And so there is something in, you were saying, modeling a certain attitude, a sort of small d-democracy approach to talking to scientists. I mean, part of this is about, you know, the world is wonderful. It's amazing. It's complicated. It seduces you into false understandings and surprises you with everything you don't know all the time. And that's okay. And so we put all that stuff out there. And so for me, I mean, there's a process here that we're constantly advertising, and it's a process of learning and of revising knowledge.
And, you know, to be wrong in this case, or to be in doubt, or to be maybe wrong at any second is the nature, it's why science and religion are different. I mean, religion gives you a truth, and hopefully, if you know are religious and you have faith, it's a truth for all time and all places, and that it's everlasting. In science, nothing is everlasting unless it's everlasting. And there's always that doubt. Like at any moment, like Carl goes, beep, you could learn, you know, one day the sun just might not come up in the east, in which case all theories are wrong from that far. And that's the interesting part. And it's learning that you live tentatively that is very hard for people. It's just the hardest part about thinking about science, mm-hmm. is that you can never be sure.
Yeah. And like, I mean, like you look at what Ira did recently with the Mike Daisy situation. He stepped right out in front of it and he said, I was wrong. Let's have a very naked, prolonged conversation about how wrong I was. And I just think that's the most, you know, noble thing you can do in that circumstance. I really do.
Okay.
I'll take a question from the internet.
Oh, internet.
So there are many people asking about how long it takes to make an episode and how we decide on topics.
How long it takes to make an episode and how we decide on the topics. Well, the length is significant.
It is. I mean, we have to put out an hour-long show every 6 weeks. So we will often have ideas, half-baked topics sort of floating around for a few months before that, sometimes a year. We were thinking of doing a show about, we've been thinking about doing a show about pain for 2 years, 3 years. Yeah. It's never happened. But these things are kind of just floating around, and at a certain point, you hit some kind of weird, spooky critical mass where you've got two things that are talking to each other, and you think, okay, I've got the raw genetic material for a show. And from that point forward, at 6 weeks, we ought to make it.
Like we released one last night called Guts. And it began, I don't know, Jad found some book called Digestive Juices, literally.
Gastric Juices.
Gastric Juices, an 1820s
bestseller. It was a bestseller. It was a
bestseller. So one day, he takes me up to a library, a rare books library in Upper Manhattan. It's one of those places where they let you into a mahogany room and they close gates and they put gloves on and everything, and they're going to bring out this precious book.
They have trepanated skulls just sitting on top of mahogany bookshelves.
And Jad is sitting there anxiously awaiting the arrival of Digestive Juices. So they bring it in. I'm thinking, like, is he insane or what? And then he takes the mic and he starts reading out loud from this book, which is the story of a guy living up in Oneida, New York, who one day, or somewhere upstate New York, Plattsburgh or someplace.
Let's make it Oneida.
Okay.
We'll just say we're wrong later.
So that somebody, there's a gun accident. Somebody shoots himself in the tummy or something, and he's got this wound, and the wound doesn't heal, so he's got a hole in his tummy. And this young doctor thinks, he's got a hole in his tummy, and he's not sick or anything. I'm going to put things in that man's tummy. So he gets a fishing rod and he starts dropping lettuce into the tummy, and then he looks like, how long does lettuce take to dissolve?
Because they didn't know how it worked. They didn't know, like, when you eat something and it goes down here, what happens?
So he's reading this book, and this book is like, it's a science book. He's like, I just put the hard tack, I just put soft boiled egg, I just put hard boiled egg, I just put lettuce, I just put, and you know, it took 3 minutes and 40 seconds and 26% of the lettuce was missing. And he just keeps reading and reading and reading, and he's like in a trance.
It turned out to be a great piece.
Yeah.
The whole time you were like, can I go now? Do I have to read about cubed pork? How long does cubed pork take?
But what happened is that the gut is that in Digestive Juices attracted the attention of Jonah Lehrer and another one of our guys. And he said, well, he said, you know that if you gave a mouse a lot of yogurt, the yogurt in the mouse's gut would put the mouse in a different mood? I said, well, yeah, I mean, if you're empty and you eat, you'd put in a different... No, in a totally different... The mouse... in humans, too, there's now science that says that that your gut is like half of a brain. It's telling your brain how to feel. And we said, well, what... And then he starts to talk about... And then one thing leads to another, and it just suddenly gets to have some kind of momentum. Mm-hmm. And Guts, which came out last night, I guess, is the result of, let's see, when did you go to the museum?
A couple months ago. Just following around for a few months.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just one of these things where, it's that whole thing that we were talking about earlier. Like, you've got this thing about a guy in a hole in his stomach. It's just a great yarn. It's like an experience. And then you've got someone like Jonah who could come in and tell you about some science that's been done to sort of explain and give context to that story. And those two things together, experience and explanation, if you get the right kind of juxtaposition, they kind of like it next to each other. And when they get next to each other and they vibrate and they're like, I like this, they kind of stand up and wave at you. And it's at that point you're like, okay, maybe we've got something. Maybe we can make a show.
And then
out
you
of
start
this.
Looking around for other gutty things, and that's when we met a man who actually didn't have one for a while. He had some kind of accident and his intestine had a sepsis, and anyway, they had to just take his tummy out and put it in a bag for a while. So he wasn't allowed to eat or drink anything, and he became a crazy person. And so we have a story about a guy who who can't eat anything, and one day a bundt cake arrives from happy neighbors so that his kids could have some dessert, and he becomes so attached to the bundt cake and so desirous that he puts his nose so close to the bundt cake that he falls into the bundt cake and then grabs the bundt cake as his 10-year-old comes in and gives him a look of intense pity.
See, we've...
And, like, that's cool. I mean, I don't know, like, you know, how many bundt cake crazy stories do you get to hear?
True.
Only if you look for them, I think.
See, we just recapitulated the entire 6-week process of making a show right in front of your eyes.
Yeah, so that's how they happen. Yeah, okay.
Question over here.
How many times do you think you personally have come across one of those loops? You know, the repeating loops.
How many times have we come across what?
The repeating loops.
Repeating loops.
Oh, repeating
just
loops.
A guess.
Well, you know, we're in the radio business, yeah. So like, if you'd ask that of a parakeet, they probably have to say zero times. Well,
I'm
maybe
so sure.
Parakeets
I bet parakeets
would,
sing the same yeah. song all
no,
the time.
No, that's wrong. That's wrong.
Yeah.
Hippopotami probably have never had repeating loops. He likes that kind of stuff.
I was starting to think, like, when have I had that experience in that piece? Not often. Not one where suddenly the character of the thing just transforms. But there are those weird kind of loops that they repeat, 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 but they never get old. You feel somehow suspended between the repetition and the sense that it could and is going somewhere. Any kind of music that fits that description, I'm all about that.
Yeah, a lot
love
of pop music has repeating loops. And a lot of rock and roll has repeating
sort
loops.
Sort of minimalist kind of stuff. I just
yeah.
like.
And that, yeah, and a lot of that weird. That has repeating loops. Oh, wow.
Wow.
Look,
wow.
It's, look at the whole cities over. Thank you for it. Look at the, wow.
It's beautiful, yeah.
If medicine gets more advanced, can we actually live forever?
Oh.
Well, you. How about you take this one, Crowe?
Well, it's funny you should ask. Last night I was at a debate where one of the people thought that if you could build a machine with enough connections and figure out how that machine would modulate itself, which is like how it would sort of work out how the connections flowed, that one day you could take all the thoughts you've ever thought and dump them into a machine. So sort of, your legs wouldn't be with you, your chest wouldn't be with you, your hair wouldn't be with you, but your mind would be in the machine and it could go on legless, hairless, toeless, and shoeless, and so forth. But it would go on, he thought, forever. And this was a room with 5 Nobel laureates and nobody went so maybe, the question to ask though, is if your mind could be put in a machine and you didn't have anyone to tickle you because you had nothing to tickle and you didn't have eyeballs and you didn't have, I don't know what that would be like. So it would be a going on, but I don't know if it would be a going on in the way that you would love. And I don't know it would be immortal in that sense. But my short answer to your question is never. But that's just my own personal belief. But there are many people who think that maybe one day something like immortality would be possible.
Hi, I was just wondering if you have any advice for the scientists that are here about how we can work more effectively with media to get the things we're passionate about out to the general public.
Get naked and go screaming in the park, set fire to your cat.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, fire is sometimes good. Well, here's I don't have any advice, but I will tell you, as a way of avoiding your question, I will tell you about my mother is a scientist. She's a molecular biologist, and I grew up watching her. She discovered or first named some protein, some really sort of minor protein involved in fat transportation through cell membranes. I don't quite understand it, but she would try very, very hard when I was a kid to get me to understand it, and she would take a napkin and a salt shaker. Napkin would be the cell, and the salt shaker would be this incoming fat globule. And she would say, you know, people used to think, Jad, that the fat globule would just get into the cell on its own, suck its way through the wall. No, it needs a little person in a canoe to take it and ferry it across the wall into the cell. That's how it works. And I just remember being so struck by her, her passion. And then there was a time when I decided I would interview my mother for the show, and she switched. I remember the moment where I was like, "Okay, Mom, sit down. Let's have a chat. You can explain. We can do the salt shaker thing again." And she switched because suddenly the microphone somehow brought to her consciousness all the colleagues that might possibly hear her speak about her science. And suddenly she switched into sciencese, and she wouldn't get passionate. She wouldn't get excited. The heat left, and I see that we see that happen a lot. And part of what we do as interviewers is to try really hard to get people back to the heat, to the passion that drives them to do what they do. And that it can feel very naked to be that person, that sort of naive, childlike person, but that's at least what we want, always. So I guess my only advice would be to be that person in front of people.
And the other thing I think is there is good reason to fear that some reporters will take what you've thought about for a long time and make it a little stupider than you want it to be. And the weariness that people who do anything complicated have when a journalist shows up is a really sensible weariness. So the other piece of advice, I guess, is just to choose, if you have admired a reporter for his or her work, particularly if it involves complexity, then you might just make your call to that reporter. Mm-hmm. Say, look, I've seen what you did, da, 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 and you seem so, I want to tell you something and tell me if you find it interesting, you know. But don't choose anybody. Choose one that you think might, now you may not have the right to choose. The reporters have bosses and they have departments, and the one you like may be at that moment covering hockey and may not be able to talk to you. But it is a wary arrangement. It is, you know, there is something real at risk, which is your work, and the reporters have something real at risk too, which is dullness. And they want to sell. And any reporter who tells you he doesn't isn't dull, except maybe if they work at Nature.
Yeah, and you know, Brian Greene, when we interview him, he always has an interesting approach, which might be useful. He's in terms of communicating what he does, he's extremely good at it. He can talk about particle physics in a way you feel like it's somehow a Spielberg film. But I remember in the interviews, he was always you'd always tiptoe up to a point where he would say something like, you know, here's the thing, these particles are colliding, but they only collide in sub-zero fourth dimensional space, and don't you dare edit that out. And let's continue. And then he would he would have a very keen sense of when to really sort of say.
He put handcuffs on certain things that he'd say.
Here's the disclaimer I'm going to make before I talk to you, and don't you dare not put that in. So he was very choice about telling us what we couldn't edit out, and those kind of boundaries are helpful sometimes for journalists.
But I'm also very aware in his case, there's a particular look he gives you. It's like having you invite an interior decorator to help you out. You know, I really love orange and tan. And they give some look at you, which is called, oh. But their lips say, well, that's a look, they say. The scientists have this, they have a telegraph. They say, well, in a way.
So we have a question. Oh, one more virtual question.
Another question from the internet. Jad, what advice do you have for a young composer?
What advice do I have for a young composer?
Oh, Lord. I don't know that I'm prepared to give advice on composing. I'm kind of a failed composer myself, who happened to somehow land in a weird amalgam of journalism where I can pretend to be a composer sometimes. So I tried to write music for films, which is what I thought I would be doing, and I failed miserably at it. So I don't really know what my advice would be, except to maybe define composition in the broadest terms possible and not be limited into what you think is or is not composing.
We can do one more, if you have one more in the house. There seems to be people there, okay.
So I heard you once speak on the radio about how you two got together. Would you go over that again?
How we met?
How we met.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Let's see. How we met. So I don't remember the year. I
remember the image. I remember looking down at ABC News. They had a very long escalator, and alongside the escalator was a big wall, and there were, and Ted Koppel, Peter Jennings, and Barbara Walters, or whoever were the favorites, were in enormous, like Kremlin-sized pictures. And you know, on the day that you disappeared, one day, Forrest Sawyer, a friend of mine who was working there, was replaced by hockey players. And he called me up and said, "Oh, I've been replaced by a generic." I said, "They're gonna lock your office any second." And sure enough, within hours, he was. So it was like a weird.
I arrived on that day.
No, you were at the bottom of that escalator.
Oh.
On a bench, because there was a bench that you called, and I was coming down to get you.
That was a remarkable little free associative thing that happened there. Yeah. So what happened was I was working at the station which produces Radio Lab WNYC. I was I was doing odd jobs, just trying to stay employed. And the guy, the program director at the time, gave me a bunch of promos to have various people read. And on the list were some various people I vaguely recognized. Andre Gregory, we just remembered the other day, Andre Gregory from My Dinner with Andre was on the list. And so was Robert Krulwich. And I don't know how these people got on this list, but anyhow, I went to visit each of them.
You paid huge dollars, huge money.
And I gave each of them a script about yay big, and I said, "Would you please read this?" And the script went something like, "I'm a proud supporter of public radio for a sensible chat that's well-balanced, da, 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 da." And then I'd say, "Thank you very much," and go on to the next person, and Robert was the last person I got to. And I remember I handed him the script, and he... In my memory, he took it from me and ripped it up into little confetti and threw it in the air.
I didn't.
And said, "I'm not reading this, you moron."
I would never say that.
He may not have said it, but in my memory, that's what's happening. but what actually happened, I think this what actually happened was that he took it, he sort of turned his back to me, madly typed something, and then, I don't know, like 45 seconds later, came up with this really hilarious 30-second promo involving oil tycoons and alien cults and weird things, and I was just like, who is this guy that he could just come up with that so fast? And so somehow we got to talking at that point, and
I said to him, like, "So, like, we're what do you do?" And he said, "Well, I work at MIC." And he said, "Yeah, it's a national degree." I said, "I know what MIC is." He says, "So that's what I'm doing. What did you do before?" He said, I worked at WBAI. I said, "Oh, that's funny. That was the first place I worked, was WBAI, and then I worked at NPR." It's funny. I said, "Where are you from?" I said, "I'm from Tennessee." Then where did you go to college? I went to Oberlin. I said, "Oh, I went to Oberlin. I went to WBAI. I went to NPR." Like, you're like doing the, you're doing the, like you're taking the same step. It's like 30 years later. However, how old are you? And then I said, "This is weird. It's like you're doing like what I did, but later."
Yeah, it was like an echo kind of thing.
So then I don't know why that would be very interesting to him. But
I think it's kind of because you were feeling emotionally raw because of the whole Forrest Sawyer thing. You needed to talk to somebody.
That happened. That wasn't later, till later. So then...
So we ended up having breakfast.
Yeah, we ended up having breakfast.
Story slightly less long. And we ended up having breakfast for months and months and months.
It was mini breakfast. It wasn't a single breakfast.
Yes, it was a single breakfast that spanned for months. And...
Some way we get to like each other. Actually.
Yeah.
I mean, the other part of this is, like, we should be frank. There's something slightly gay about this whole thing, but we do like each other a lot, and somehow that just happened.
Gay in the old sense, and that, you know, delightful.
Yes, in the 1890s sense. Yeah. Not that there's anything wrong with the 1890s. So one of the things actually that when we decided to do it, I said, let's not be afraid. I said, you know, people may not like science, but they like affection, and they like people who are clearly into each other, mm-hmm. and they like warmth, because we're all animals. And one of the things that we advertise in addition to politics and everything else is like just what friends do together. Like it's a sort of, you know, it's an odd friendship because we're different ages and everything, and that even makes it sort of interesting. It's just that I found it completely wonderful, to be honest, from the beginning till right now. And all the way through it. I mean, we have huge fights from time to time, but it's really
in a way, it's sort of anchored in my memory by the fact that we would have breakfasts every, I mean, somehow when we get into these thickets where we don't know how to tell a story and how do we edit this, and always the saving thought is, okay, how can I funnel this through the memory of those two guys sitting at the table having breakfast? That's how it started, and if we can somehow make it make sense between those two people at that time, then it'll make sense to anyone else. That's kind of the sort of the bottom line for us.
Yeah, that sounds like a good ending place, too. So thank you all very much.
Yes, thank you so much.